This is the third in a series of Bible studies, looking at our relationship to the environment, or our relationship to the creation, and looking at biblical materials in an effort to help us understand better that relationship and responsibility. Let's begin our time this morning with prayer. We are mindful, Lord, of the gifts which come from your hand, the gift of the earth itself, the gift of life, and the gift of redeeming grace. Bless us this morning. Open our hearts and minds to your word, to your spirit, for thy son's sake. Amen. We want to look today especially at our relationship as Christians and the relationship of the people of Israel to the earth and specifically to the land. At the beginning, I want to give a brief commercial. I've been drawing different books and resources that Mary has in the bookstore to your attention these mornings. And today I just want to lift up this book, The Land by Walter Brueggemann. I think a very helpful biblical study of how the land is treated, especially in the Old Testament. There is another more scholarly work for any of you who would wish to pursue this further. It's not in the bookstore. You might be able to find it in the library. It's called The Gospel and the Land by W.D. Davies. Brueggemann is indebted to Davies' studies, although they come to some different conclusions when they look at how these themes are treated into the New Testament. This one book, however, would be, I think, well worth your attention. One of the places to begin, and oftentimes in this study, we've been beginning at those places where passages seem to be problematic or seem to raise questions that we don't quite know how to answer. We want to take up today where we left off yesterday in the Genesis account, but particularly now in the account after the fall in Genesis 3. You might remember that a question on this score was asked, I think, the first day. After the fall, we read that there's a series of curses and that are given. And one of them in Genesis 3:17 reads this way. This is the curse given to man as opposed to the curse given to woman in the verses before. Because you have listened to your wife and have eaten of the tree which I forbade you, accursed shall be the ground on your account. With labor you shall win your food from it all the days of your life. It will grow thorns and thistles for you, none but wild plants for you to eat. You shall gain your bread by the sweat of your brow until you return to the ground, for from it you were taken, dust you are, to dust you shall return. We referred to this briefly yesterday. What is the nature of this curse that's given? It's a curse in the relationship between humanity and the ground and the earth, rather than regarding it as though the earth or the ground itself bore the curse. I think the more we look at it, we see that it's the relationship which bears the brunt of this curse. How humanity relates to the earth in this account has what is traditionally called a curse or punishment. There is another dimension to this when it says, "You shall eat the wild plants, the plants of the field." some interpreters take that to mean that this is the way in which the writers of the Genesis understood humanity up until this time, being a gatherer, being nomadic, not being engaged in agriculture, but simply having to go and pick wild plants, the sort of thing that Don Kurtz can tell us about how to do, and something that, in fact, we might get back to for some other reasons. Now, we move on in this account with this verse in mind. We haven't answered this question, really. We've just sort of held it up. And we immediately see in chapter 4 the story of Cain and Abel and the jealousy between the two, and Cain slaying Abel. Story that we're all familiar with. But I want to draw your attention to verse 9. Then the Lord said to Cain, this is after Cain has murdered Abel, where is your brother Abel? Cain answered, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? Now, you remember we talked yesterday about Genesis, about in the Genesis accounts, Genesis 2:15, to till and to keep the garden being one of the commands given. The word there, to keep, shamar, is the exact same word used here. Thus you see that the disorder in the relationship that has set in as a result of the fall means that no longer is humanity able to be the proper keeper of the creation. But in fact, Cain says, am I supposed to be my brother's keeper? The whole sense of watching, preserving, keeping the creation is distorted, is broken, and broken at its most grave point, this sense of keeping towards another human being. The sense of keeping the creation is the command, the injunction given to God's people. Not only other people, but the whole creation. Now that focuses in our relationships with one another. It extends outward to all. Cain asks the essential question, not just do I have a responsibility for another person, but he asks the question, do I have any responsibility for your creation anyway? That's the underlying kind of question asked when Cain says, am I my brother's keeper? As this account goes on through the fourth chapter, you read in verse 10, the Lord said, what have you done? Hark, your brother's blood that has been shed is crying out to me from the ground. Now that you are accursed, now you are accursed and banished from the ground, which has opened its mouth wide to receive your brother's blood, which you have shed. Whenever you till the ground, it will no longer yield you its wealth. You will become a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth. Cain said to the Lord, my punishment is heavier than I can bear. Thou hast driven me today from the ground, and I must hide myself from thy presence. I shall be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth. Now, you see the relationship between the earth, the ground, and sin. The distortion which comes as a result of sin to Cain is an alienation from the earth. The punishment for Cain's sin is that he is to be alienated from the ground, from the earth, the ground, the dust out of which humanity was created. Same word out of which Adam comes. So one of the things that the Old Testament, that this passage is saying to us, that our violence against others, in this case, the act of killing, but as our violence against others, as a mark of the sin, as a mark of our sin, this, a consequence of this action is our alienated relationship to the earth. Sin has its consequences in in an alienated and estranged relationship to creation. It's a way in which we normally do not think, but a theme which we see repeated frequently in the Old Testament. There is a connection between our sins towards other people and our relationship to all the creation. This is fruit for further thought. I just want to plant a seed here. Tomorrow we observe Hiroshima Day. And one can think about the results of the bomb of nuclear arms, a manifestation of our willingness to do mass murder towards others. Isn't one of the results a total alienation from the earth? What more signifies an alienation from the creation than the willingness to destroy it? See, to make the connection between our relationship towards other people and our relationship towards the creation. Sins against others have consequences in our relationship to the environment. Cain becomes a wanderer, is alienated from the land, and as you read on, and here I just want to make a brief note of this in verse 17. After Cain bears this this curse, being a vagrant and a wanderer, alienated from the earth, he says he goes off and lives in the in the land of Nod, which means the land of wandering. That's what that word means. And what does he do there? He bears a son, and then he builds a city. The first account in the Bible about the building of a city is put clearly in the context of being alienated from the earth. Now, there's a lot more one can do or say about that. And if you really want to pursue some of those questions, you take a look at Jacques Ellul's book, The Meaning of the City, if you want a kind of provocative and stimulating look at the place of cities in the Old Testament. And our place here is not to say, is city life better or worse than urban than rural life, but is to simply point out that this is a manifestation, as we read it here, of Cain's wandering and alienating stance towards the earth. What we're saying is that this curse of God, which we read, is not given to the earth itself, but comes in our relationship to the environment. You can pick up other passages, Isaiah 1:3, for instance, which talks about ox and cattle know their place, but Israel, my people, they have no knowledge. In Jeremiah 8:7, you read that the stark, it knows how to migrate, the dove, it knows the season of its return, but my people do not know the ordinances of the Lord. In other words, there's a sense in which creation has a deeper awareness of its relationship to God than my own people do. But even more, is the father of Ellen Bakke here?
Or mother?
No.
Okay, sure. But when we look to the prophet Hosea, I think we see this lifted up even more directly. Let me find all my bookmarks here. In Hosea, in the fourth chapter, we read, "Hear the word of the Lord, O Israel, for the Lord has a charge to bring against the people of the land. There is no good faith or mutual trust, no knowledge of God in the land. All oaths are imposed and broken, they kill and rob. There is nothing but adultery and license, one deed of blood after another. Therefore the land shall be dried up, and all who live in it pine away, and with them the wild beasts and the birds of the air, even the fish, shall be swept from the sea." That's Hosea 4, verses 1 through 3. simply repeating the notion that our sins and disobedience towards God have an effect on how we relate to all creation. Now back to Genesis, we see a progression and a change somewhat in this situation when we come to the story of Noah. And I suggested yesterday that you might have wanted to look at the account of Noah in preparation for today. In the first reference to Noah, when he is born, which comes in chapter 5, verse 29, we read, "This boy will bring us relief from our work and from the hard labor that has come upon us because of the Lord's curse upon the ground." The very first reference towards Noah indicates that this curse towards man's relationship to the ground is in fact to find some relief, to find some promise and some hope with the birth of Noah. And as the story of Noah progresses and we go through the flood and Noah's faithfulness, God's faithfulness to Noah and Noah's household, we find the covenant which God gives to Noah after the ark has landed and Noah has given his sacrifice. And this is the initial time in the Bible when the sense of covenant appears. This starts at the end of the 8th chapter and continues through the 9th chapter. And there is here the first sign that in spite of the fact that there is violence and wickedness and alienation from God in creation, yet God will be faithful, God will renew, God will bring God's promises to his people, will establish a covenant, not only with his people, but a covenant with all creation. This is the promise that's given in the 8th and 9th chapter. And beginning in verse 21 of the 8th chapter, I want you to note, this is when the Lord sees the sacrifice of Noah. He said within himself, this is the Lord, "Never again will I curse the ground because of man, however evil his inclinations may be from his youth upwards." Thus, immediately you see that the kind of curse which we read about in the Old Testament, there is already in the story of Adam and of Cain, is already changed through God's covenant. In the covenant given to Noah, it is specifically said that the ground no longer bears this kind of curse. Now, that doesn't mean that everything is, that everything is fine, that man's relationship to creation is fully restored, but it does mean that through God's action in God's covenant, the situation is changed. It's one thing that the rainbow is the sign of, in being the sign of God's covenant. Commands then are then given to Noah, much like the commands we find in the first and second chapter of Genesis. In verse 9, "Be fruitful and increase and fill the earth." Chapter 9, verse 1. The covenant is spelled out, which now includes animals as being a source of food. Before Noah, this was not the case. Although a prohibition against eating the blood of any animals and a prohibition against shedding the blood of any other person, which you find in Genesis 9:6. And in 9:7, "You must be fruitful and increase and bring forth abundantly," is the correct translation. All sense of subduing the earth, the problematic verse which we read about and considered earlier in Genesis 1:28, is no longer present. It's specifically not there. And we could speculate, well, why is this? And the reason, I think, almost self-evident. Humanity, before the fall, can be spoken of in a proper way of humanity's ruling over the earth, even using a word as strong as subduing, because there's no break, there's no alienation in the relationship. After the fall, The words spoken are simply words of being fruitful, increasing, bringing forth abundantly, rather than the strong sense of subduing. The other thing that we find in the covenant given to Noah is that five times it's stated, this covenant is between God and living things on the earth of every kind. I'm reading now from verse 17 in the ninth chapter. This sign of the covenant which I make, me and the rainbow, which I make between myself and all that lives on the earth. Thus, God's covenant is not a covenant simply with people. It is a covenant with creation. And by creation, what is understood is all that is created, including all people and all creation and their relationship. That's the focus of God's covenant. It then, with this as the background, it then says that Noah becomes a man of the soil, planting and began the planting of vineyards. Thus the picture, the predominant picture in Genesis, in the Bible, of the first person who engages in agriculture in a consistent way, although there are references earlier, comes in the context of this covenant being established between God and all of the creation, and comes with the sense that we no longer are given a command to subdue, but rather a command of being responsible to God for the covenant which God has made for all the creation. Now I want to move on quickly to hold up some other themes of the land and the people of God which appear in the Old Testament. Some of this is from Brueggemann. In fact, John Schramm this morning, in making his announcement about Give Us This Day Our Daily Bread, intercessory prayer, simply stole one of my points unwittingly. No, it's quite all right. It just gave us better preparation. There are a variety of different relationships that we find in the Old Testament as the story of the people of Israel begins, especially with Abraham. Abraham is called away from the land where he is toward a land that is not yet possessed. He has to leave in a posture of faith, looking towards fulfillment. Note what I said earlier from Noah and what we find here. God's promises are not simply a promises to a people, but a promises to a people in relationship to creation. The promises extend to creation as well. We think so often of simply God's promises to the people. When we construct a whole theology of God's mighty saving acts in history, we can think as if God is concerned about people apart from the creation. And this simply is not the biblical picture. The covenant itself, as I said, is extended to a people in their relationship to their land, to the earth, to the creation. And in the beginning of Abraham, we see this in terms of looking for a land which is promised. The experience of the wilderness, the experience of extreme vulnerability, of being without, of being landless. The wilderness is the place where the people's identity is formed, where their trust in God and their waiting and their patience becomes clear in order to prepare them for the land. To prepare them for having the land. That's why the wilderness comes first. The wilderness is the place of preparation. And then the land itself, which we see in the Old Testament in terms of the promised land, a specific batch of territory as it's first presented. What we find is the great temptations that territory presents to the people of Israel. You find this in the accounts of where the people first come to the River Jordan and look out towards the land before the Jordan is crossed. You find it in the Jubilee scriptures. One of them, just briefly, I'd read from Leviticus 25:23. No land shall be sold outright, because the land is mine, and you are coming into it as aliens and settlers. Throughout the whole land of your patrimony, you shall allow land which has been sold to be redeemed. The sense that this land is a possession of the Lord. Psalm 24 echoes this. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof and all that dwells therein. And the land becomes the place where the people settle, is given to the people, not by the people's power, not by the people's coercion, but because of Yahweh. And underlying the whole story of what is often called the conquest of the promised land is the continual truth repeated again and again. This land is the gift of Yahweh. This sense is repeated because the prophets knew that the land has a seductive power, that we can cling to it, want to possess it, want to rule over it in the sense of subdue in Genesis 1:28, want to own it, want to act towards the land in a distorted relationship, in a relationship which speaks more of our alienation from God, and thus our alienation from the land also. The problem is to act as if Yahweh no longer owns the land, and what that means for the prophets is that then Yahweh is not your Lord. If you act towards the land as if Yahweh doesn't own it, then it means that the Lord is not your God. You see, the connection is made very clearly with the prophets. Why the prophets have so much problem with the concept of kingship and the warnings against horses and wives and silver and gold? Well, horses meant armies. Wives meant continual marriages in order to get more territory. And silver and gold meant reaping and raping, really, the resources of the land. Kingship was the mechanism for accumulating and controlling and grasping the land. And it's for that reason that we read the prophetic warnings and utterances against relating to the land in that way. The passage that I read from Hosea echoes that warning. Now, an interesting and very enlightening picture is to look in the rabbinical tradition, look in the history of the Jewish people, look in how their rabbis developed a sense of responsibility towards the creation, and how that has been developed within their tradition in order to underscore what it means for the land to be owned by the Lord. There's a strange little verse in Deuteronomy 20:19, which reads like this: "When you are at war and lay siege to a city for a long time in order to take it, do not destroy its trees by taking the axe to them, for they provide you with food. You shall not cut them down." That one verse has become in the history of Jewish thought and tradition, in the rabbinical tradition, the basis for a whole series of Jewish laws or regulations towards the environment. They are called specifically the Baal Tashit, which means do not destroy. The rabbinical tradition is that you take a passage from the Torah, and in order to understand it, turn it over and over again and try to continually get the full meaning and interpret the full meaning of it. And in this particular verse, a prohibition against the cutting of trees, except under certain circumstances, is given under the most extraordinary of circumstances, under circumstance when you're at war. Here the people are at war, but they're prohibited from doing something that would seem to be a very natural thing to do in a situation of war. What is taken from that is that if this prohibition should exist even during a time of war, how much more should there be a sense, a consciousness of our responsibility in other situations, in times of peace? And for those of you who would be interested, and I think this is fascinating, in the history of rabbinic thought, from this verse and other certain other verses in the first five books of the Old Testament, the Baal Tashit has developed, including regulations that prohibit the following: the cutting off of water supplies to trees, the overgrazing of the countryside, the unjustified killings of animals or feeding them of harmful foods, hunting animals for sport, actions which would result in the extinction of species, the destruction of cultivated plant varieties, the pollution of air and water, the overconsumption of anything, the waste of mineral or of other resources. Again, in Jewish rabbinical tradition, all those things are prohibited, and it states that those who transgress against this law are compared to idolaters. They're not allowed to appear as witnesses. They're not allowed to engage in prayers. In effect, they're cut off from the community. This is the official attitude. Now, one can always ask, as one can ask about the Jubilee, how rigorously was this upheld? The point is that this detailed sort of set of regulations in the history of the Jewish people, as rabbis have continually commented on these passages, this sort of history and tradition clearly exists. Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, a great 19th century rabbi, summarizes the meaning of this whole law to a religious Jew. "Do not destroy anything is the first and most general call of God, which comes to you, man, when you realize yourself as master of the earth. God's call proclaims to you, if you destroy, you ruin. At that moment, you are not a man, you are an animal, and you have no right to the things around you. I lent them to you for wise use only. Never forget that I lent them to you. As soon as you use them unwisely, be it the greatest or the smallest, you commit treachery against my world. You commit murder and robbery against my property. You sin against me." So you see, even within the rabbinical tradition, in the Jewish faith up to today, we find a very strong sense of what it means for the earth to be the Lord's. Now let's turn briefly to the story in 1 Kings 21. And I want to close with this. I don't have time to read it all. I want to simply acquaint you with it. Naboth of Jezreel had a vineyard near the palace of Ahab, the king of Samaria. How many of you are familiar with this story? Okay. Ahab makes a proposal to Naboth. "Your vineyard is close to my place. Let me have it for a garden. I will give you a better vineyard in exchange, or if you prefer, its value in silver." But Naboth answered, "The Lord forbid that I should let you have the land which..." In this translation, it says, "which has always been in my family." Other translations would say, "the land of my inheritance," which really means the land given to the people of God from Yahweh. The story goes on that Ahab gets very angry, and Ahab's wife, Jezebel, suggests to Ahab that he find a means for getting Naboth killed, which Ahab then does. Ahab kills Naboth and then takes possession of the vineyard, which Naboth had refused to sell. Upon this all occurring, the prophet Elijah comes and confronts Ahab and announces the Lord's judgment upon him. What is pictured here are two views of how we relate to the land. The way Ahab related to the land was to take it, possess it. Either you buy it or you use force to get it, but land is coveted. I see this land, I want to have it, I'm going to get it. I'm going to own it, I'm going to control it. It's going to be mine. And Naboth's relation to the land isn't mine to be sold. How can I, you want me to sell you this land? You want me to trade it? This land isn't mine. It isn't mine to sell to you, to give to you for any kind of a deal. This is the land of my people, the land given by Yahweh, the land of my inheritance, the land which has been entrusted to me, lent to me. I can't sell what's been lent to me. You see? And also note the relationship between the earth, how we relate to the land, and violence. Here again, it's murder which is the result of coveting the land. The prophet in Micah, which with most likely this story in mind, in the second chapter we read, "Shame on those who lie in bed, planning evil and wicked deeds, and rise at daybreak to do them, knowing that they have the power. They covet land and take it by force. If they want a house, they seize it. They rob a man of his home, and they steal every man's inheritance." Land is a gift of Yahweh. If our relationship to the earth comes as Yahweh's gift, it's not ours to possess, to take, to own, to treat as if it were our own. The final implication of this, which we read in the Old Testament, is our stance towards others who are in the land, towards those without land or without power, the poor, the widow, the stranger, the sojourner. And the word that comes is that these two who do not possess the land are really heirs of the land. Thus, all the injunctions in the Old Testament about treating the widow, the stranger, the sojourner, the one within your midst who doesn't have, they're to be given, to be treated as if they too are heirs, because they are. Why? Because God owns. If God owns, then all are heirs. Land is the gift of God, then those dispossessed from the land also are to receive it. Excuse me?
I can get that reference from Micah.
Micah 2, verses 1 through 3. Well, where does this bring us? The final message, consistent throughout the Old Testament, echoed even in the stories of creation itself, are that by clinging and attempting to possess the land, claiming it as if it were our own, we lose it. And this, in fact, is the story of Israel. Because the Old Testament ends with where our theme for the time, Sing the Lord's Song, comes from, is from the relationship of the people of Israel in exile. Our relationship to the earth, to the land, comes as God's gift. We can use New Testament language to say it comes by God's grace, not by our deserving or achieving or getting it, because this is the way to loss and to death, but rather by opening ourselves to the earth as God's gift, which means being created in God's image. Because what did we say yesterday about the image of God acting in the earth as God's representative, as God's agent, acting as God's own agent towards the whole creation, because God is the owner. In this sense, all are included. It is a gift for all people. A new unity is established. The whole picture in the Old Testament of Shalom, which we haven't really mentioned at all, it is found here, because the creation is God's creation for all people, a part of that creation. And it is perhaps with this in mind that our Lord says, "Blessed or good for you if you are meek, humble in spirit, receiving as a gift. For the meek shall inherit what?
The earth."
Let's stop there for questions.
I'd like to ask which translation of the Bible you're using, because yours reads so differently from the one that I have.
I'm usually using the New English Translation.
Is this the New Jerusalem Bible you're using there
no,
now?
No, it's a New English.
Oh, well, this one is the Revised Standard.
Mm-hmm.
And it, when God is speaking to Noah, he says, the water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. And then he goes on to the covenant, which I have established between me and all flesh that is upon the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And these can be taken, should not perhaps be taken that literally, because as you were explaining it, this means all creation rather than all flesh.
The best translation, and it's repeated five times in that portion, is all living creatures. The New English says all living things on the earth of every kind, all that lives on the earth, every living creature that is with you, between myself and living things of every kind. I will never again kill every living creature. I'm just going to look and see what the King James says. Maybe some of you have it there. In the Interpreter's Bible, which is this using the RSV? What does it say in verse 12? Between you and every living creature that is with you? Is that the way it reads in your translation, verse 12?
This is a sign of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature.
Every living creature, right.
That is with you.
Right. It's every living creature is the correct translation. Or is a translation that's closest to the intention.
Then it depends upon what we categorize as a creature, whether it's a plant or...
That's right, because you can also read that as every living thing.
Yeah.
The King James uses the word in that verse of creature. The sense which is, I think, crystal clear, even from any of the translations, even the ones that say with all flesh, is that the covenant is with humanity and the creation. It's a covenant that extends to all the creation. And so often we've understood covenant much more narrowly, understood it simply as applying to a people. And again, I think it's clear to say that's just not a way in which the Old Testament mind would think, and not in a way in which the message is given. God's covenant is that which is established between God and the creation, and God's people. But a part of that covenant is how God's people relate to their environment, to their creation.
The covenant becomes dependent on the Old Testament, on how they live in the land. How they live in the land, how they treat others in the land. The covenant's conditioned on it. I hope you see the significance of what we're trying to point to here. The way in which God's promises are simply not only promises for individuals or promises for people, but promises for our creation and thus how we relate to the world should flow out of our sense of God's covenant with us today as God's people. I hope that tomorrow and the next day, I hope that what I will want to do is both move into the New Testament, but try to bring this down into what this means for how we live. I mean, maybe you think, well, this is just a lot of, you know, wandering through obscure Old Testament passages, and what in the world does this mean for me anyway? I think it means a great, great deal for how we live, for how we eat, just how we conduct our lives every day. I think it means a lot. It would mean a lot to Holden Village for the kinds of choices Holden Village is trying to make about what energy it uses. Why in the world are they, they have solar panels on the laundry? Why are they building a solar kiln? What about this extension right to the left of us? What they're doing with extending koinonia and how they're trying to do that. Well, all of that is wrapped up in an understanding of God's covenant with the creation and our role in that as God's people. And what I'm trying to suggest is that understanding the sense of our being in the world as merely the agents, the representatives of God who owns the world. The more we take that seriously, the more that will have deep implications for the shape that our lives and our churches might take. So I hope this doesn't remain obscure and theoretical and irrelevant for us, but that it'll come down to earth. Absolutely.
Yeah. If you really live in common with the faith too, mm-hmm. you'll feel that.
Right. Yes.
When you speak of God's covenant with all creation, including not only human beings, any significance to the expression in geology and earthquakes of the fault in the earth?
No, I don't think there's any connection there specifically. You do raise the broader and, I think, quite profound issue. What about the decay? Yesterday someone spoke about entropy, right? The sense, the essential entropic nature of creation, meaning things run down, things run out. Any of you who have had any even physics or biology would know what I mean when I say this. How does that fit into God's covenant with creation? I don't have an answer for that except to suggest one of the passages I want you to look at for tomorrow is Romans 8. It talks about creation being subject to decay but waiting its redemption. And also look at Colossians 1 if you have time and inclination for our session tomorrow. Again, just identify that. I think specifically, I don't think there's a connection in terms of the word fault and so forth, but more broadly what you're saying, I just identify as an issue which both the Old Testament thought about and which even I think is reflected in certain passages in the New Testament. How do we understand it?
You know, the parallels between these Old Testament directives and the religion and life of the Indians is mm-hmm. just so amazing. And one wonders how the Indians, you know, how this developed as mm-hmm. far as the religion and the basis for their life.
It's a very good issue, and I think those of us particularly who live in this part of the country, although it would be so for people living anywhere, but it seems in at least in this part of the country, the sense of Indian or Native American culture is a little closer and more accessible to us. I think that there are deep things which can be learned. Not in a sense that any culture is elevated as being a perfect expression of humanity's relationship to creation. It's not that at all. But I think what the Native American culture point up to us is the degree to which modern Western culture is living in such disharmony with, in such a distorted relationship to the creation, and how much our connections have been cut off in ways which we, you know, usually are not aware of, are not conscious of. You don't have only Native American cultures to look to. A historian of cultures would find similarities in many other mm-hmm. sorts of cultures. One thing that is very suggestive, however, and it is provocative, a certain similarity that does exist between many of the accounts in the Old Testament story and the life of Native peoples You would also find differences as well. And even in the Jewish tradition, you would find, you know, certain points of difference around where does God's Spirit actually reside? Is God's Spirit to be equated with the creation or certain parts of the creation? No, that's a major difference. And even the in thought, even from the beginning of the Old Testament, one of the distinctive things about the people of Israel was their refusal to identify God as being identical to parts of creation. And a refusal to equate, to regard nature in an the simple word is animism, to worship certain parts of nature as if that were God. Now, I think what we have lost sight of, and this is of course one thing that environmentalists often charge, to say the Judeo-Christian heritage, you know, when it rejected animism, it just rejected the sense of value in anything that isn't human. Well, maybe Christians have acted that way, but there's no sense of that at all in the Old Testament. God's transcendence, the ways in which God is transcendent, which God's name, I am what I am, can't be identified as identical to any point of creation, never means that creation itself is without any value. Quite the opposite. Quite the opposite. Not making an idol out of parts of creation, in fact, brings creation into a full stance of we relate to it as God's own possession. It's not just what God is; it's rather God owns it. This is God's gift. And it is that sense, even in the Jewish tradition, which was different from most of the other religions around the time of Judaism, and marks a distinctive kind of note in part of our Judeo-Christian tradition. The unfortunate thing is that we have interpreted that in I think quite a wrong way, at least in our modern times. Interpret that to mean somehow this what the stuff of creation is stuff that has no value. It's a long answer to really just agreeing with what you're saying. Absolutely. Absolutely. You find these passages in Native Americans, and many of you probably know this, that when Indians were asked to sell their land to white settlers, their reaction was just like the reaction of Nabal. What do you mean? I can't sell this land. I don't own it. I mean, their concept of owning and possessing land and then selling it was about, I mean, the white settlers were the Ahab and the Indians were the Nabal in the story. It's true. This is how they related to the earth. They didn't relate to the earth as something which was theirs to be possessed and owned and bought and sold.
Really hope I'm not misunderstood. My training is in half in anthropology, actually, and half in biology, which ends up in human ecology. And this Indian thing is really pretty badly misunderstood by the majority of the European population in America. Quite true, their religion, when it comes to the treatment of nature, was extremely similar to Old Testament theology, and don't harm this, and don't overexploit this, and so on. But in actual fact, the people themselves really have acted very much as the Christians have acted, and in actual fact did overexploit this environment. You know, I could go on for hours giving you examples from virtually every group. And the new world had at one time or another destroyed substantial portions of the environment. To give you a couple of examples, there's a canyon called Taco Canyon in northern New Mexico, which is a national monument now, which has fantastic federal ruins in it. the people of Earth just created, they made roads up to 150 miles in length of the cities of stone and so on. They cursed up the land. It was a lovely farm road to pine covered country with flowing streams to the sand and gold and cottonwood. And they actually cleared the forest from the land for building the timber and building the settlers. Since the climate was on a threshold of aridity, it seems the climate sufficiently for over about a 50-year span of time, the things dried up. The beavers had to leave, and people who were agriculturalists lost their water supply, but they also had to leave. And then they moved south to go down along the Rio Grande and do the same thing all over again, although if the Rio Grande originated high up in the Rockies, they could not. Stop its flow. But they really did thoroughly destroy the environment there in the Copper Canyon. The Great Plains is another interesting thing. There is no biological reason why the Great Plains in most areas could not be forested. In fact, in areas that are naturally fire protected, like rocky areas, rocky knolls and so on, there are trees throughout the Great Plains. And most farmers have had a great deal of trouble I have grown trees there. My own family, part of it comes from the Great Plains, and my grandfather was there in 1911, found his large windbreak, and never watered them. They did any of it, they grew. The reason the trees aren't there is because Indians burned the Great Plains regularly. And they did this because it did increase certain kinds of their parts of their food supply, but it also destroyed vast amounts of that kind of environment. Also, before the horse came, they would, with fire and other means, stampede literally thousands of buffalo into the rivers, over cliffs, into fire, and then, which they would die, of course, and then they would only use a few. It was, of course, difficult for them to capture just a few buffalo, but still, I think we as a European origin population here and there, but we need to realize that there were a lot of buffalo and all, but their relationship wasn't as perfect as humanity's fiction tends to make it out. Their religion, certainly like our own, certainly did tell them to conserve and not overuse and not overexploit, and spiritually they were very close to one. But in actual fact, they tended to police their environment just like we tend to do
else. I think that's very helpful, Don, because as I say, we can't assume that any culture has lived in a perfect relationship, in a relationship that is free from some, or in some respect, of the fall. And I think that there is a danger in over-idealizing. I think that in terms of a contrast with our own Western mentality, it's helpful to look and to find what kind of contrast is there.
But I agree wholeheartedly.
But I think there's always a danger in trying to locate some idyllic period that existed somewhere in some culture before us, and, that we're not going to find.
Right.
Well, tomorrow, We'll look into the New Testament and hopefully bring these things down closer to home. And as I say, if you have the opportunity, you might want to look at Romans 8 and the first chapter of Colossians.